see errors or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll look back at the recent Excellence in Government Conference with author Dan Rome and Hooks Book Events President Perry Pigeon Hooks. We'll also address efforts to extend payroll tax cuts with Campaign for America's Future co-director Roger Hickey.
We've been joined now by Dan Rome, the author of Blah, 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 What to Do When Words Don't Work. Dan, welcome to the program.
Jason, thank you so much.
Sitting here with you today at the Excellence in Government Conference in Washington, D.C., tell us about what you're doing here today as, of course, the keynote speaker for the luncheon.
I will be talking to people after lunch, which is always can be the really a good time to talk or kind of a bad time to talk. So I like to put a lot of energy into my conversation. What we're going to be talking about is how not to be blah, 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 how not to make sure that we're talking too much. See, Jason, the concern that I have these days, and I'm becoming increasingly worried about it, is it feels to me like we spend so much time talking that we're actually kind of forgetting how to think. And it's obviously a point of great concern to me. So what I want to do is help us move beyond this point where we just talk about things all the time. See, what's really happened is that we have become, we've so fallen in love with our ability to be verbal that we've actually let our verbal abilities kind of delude us a little bit into thinking that we understand things better than we probably do. We kind of find ourselves thinking, if I can talk about something knowledgeably, I probably know a lot about it. And there is, let's face it, there's a lot of truth there. But I think that it's less than half the equation. The other half is what I refer to as the visual part of our mind. Our verbal minds are well developed. What is not well developed is our visual mind. And from a kind of a statistical neurobiological perspective, that's a bad place to be, because far more of our mind actually processes vision than processes words. We've got a lot more computing horsepower available to us when we start thinking in pictures than we do when we think in words. So my big push, what I'm going to talk about at lunch today, is bringing the two back together, our verbal mind and our visual mind, back together.
How did that happen? How did the visual get lost and get replaced by the verbal?
Well, we have about a 5,000-year history of that, and I'm glad you asked me. So it turns out, not surprisingly, that originally humans were visual. I mean, if you go back and you think about the cave paintings in Lascaux, and even older than that, the cave paintings in central France, recently discovered in the caves of Chauvet, 32,000 years old. These represent the oldest markings that we've ever, the oldest drawings or markings of any sort that we've ever found from people. 32,000 years ago. It's a long time. Then we jump forward to about 5,000 years ago, which was the first time that we had recorded history in words. And that was with hieroglyphics in Egypt and cuneiform over in sort of the golden, the golden triangle there of Iran, Iraq, that area. What's interesting is that since then, 5,000 years ago, we have increasingly pushed pictures out of our communications and come especially to rely on the words. There are a lot of reasons why that is, and some of them are great, valid reasons. The fact, Jason, that you and I can have this conversation now with nothing more than recording our voice, and hopefully it will make sense to most of your listeners, is an example of how powerful words can be. But let's face it, if you and I wanted to talk about something as complex as healthcare reform, just to pick a hot button in D.C. these days and one that I have a certain amount of experience with, the problem is we have a lot of really smart people. The problems associated with healthcare are so multi-layered and so complex and so multidimensional, they cannot be described with words. It is impossible.
As I understand, you have taken this massive document and simplified it down into something that is easier to understand with the use of pictures. Is that right?
Yes, what I did, I became concerned about 2.5 years ago, as many people did, when the Obama administration started health care reform and people started going to these town hall meetings and bringing guns and getting in fights. I thought, literally, you know, dude, where's my country? This doesn't make sense. This is health care reform. This is meant to be something that we should at least embrace thinking about. This is good for everybody. So what I thought is, what is the problem here? Why are so many people reacting so strongly against healthcare reform, which on the surface of it sounds like a good thing? And I came to the conclusion in following the news and reading the documentation and reading the legislation, the problem is not that people disagree with what Washington is saying. The problem is that nobody understands what Washington is saying. And in the lack of clarity, in the lack of understanding, people will turn on their worries. The things, you know, is it about death panels? Is it about killing grandma? Well, that's nowhere in the legislation, I know, because read through the legislation. But because it was poorly communicated what health care reform was really about, because it was too much blah, 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 we're left for the most part as the voting electorate to say, well, what do I think it means? And I don't like the sound of that, and I don't like the sound of that, I'm going to reject it. So what I did, what Dan did, I went in and I said, well, if we want to make it so that people can understand it, perhaps my approach with what I call vivid thinking, the combination of the verbal and the visual, words and pictures, maybe this is a good opportunity to try something. So I have some background in working with healthcare companies across the United States, but I'm not really an expert. But I have worked with enough people that I do know the experts. And I called together a couple of close friends, people who know healthcare really well. We locked ourselves in a room, and we said we're not leaving until we've taken the essentials of healthcare reform and mapped them out in a series of simple pictures that literally anybody could understand. And that's what we did. I took those pictures, each one of which is very simple. Each one just contains a couple of stick figures and a little bit of notation, a caption. It ended up being 43 pictures long, 43, but really, in essence, it's four essential ideas. The first one of which, for example, and I promise I won't bore your listeners with it all now, is that the first thing we have to understand in the United States when we think about health care reform is that uniquely in the U.S., unique among any developed economy, healthcare in the U.S. is a profit-driven business, which is unusual. We're pretty much the only big nation that has a 100% profit-driven healthcare system. Now, that's not a problem in and of itself. That's just the way we do things here. The problem is, if you look at that, it's actually two different businesses. One is the business of the doctors in the hospitals, the people who make money by making us well, and one is the business of the insurers, the people who make money by monitoring the flow of money. So far, so good, and I hope you're able to follow me, because I'm trying to actually verbally map out the pictures that I drew. The balance, though, falls apart because the two businesses don't like each other anymore. The business of the doctors and the business of the insurance companies. Both have limited amount of funds that they can get access to, which are coming out of our pockets as taxpaying employed citizens. Both of them trying to maximize how much they can get from us. So something has to give. So point is, I made this series of simple pictures. I posted them online on a website called slideshare.net, which is a place where people can share PowerPoints. Now think about this, Jason. Here you have a 43-page PowerPoint document about healthcare reform. What could be more boring on earth? But the fact is, it was 43 simple little pictures. And within a couple of weeks, 500,000 people had downloaded this and gone through it. Then it got picked up by the Huffington Post, the online news agency. Then it went viral. Then I was asked by Fox News to come on air and see if I would be willing to share my pictures with the American public. On Fox News, I said yes. Then shortly after that, I got in contact with the White House Office of Communications. And they said, Dan, would you be willing to come in here and share how you have been able to kind of rebuild healthcare reform in these series of simple pictures? So now I've had an opportunity on a couple of occasions to go into the White House and work with them. So the point I want to make is, the original question, did I successfully translate the entire healthcare bill into pictures? No. I didn't want to translate all of it. There's a lot of detail in there which is important for it to be a functional law. But what I did translate is the underlying structure of what we have now and what we will have post-reform. And out of that, it can be boiled down into not simplistic, but simple, clear pictures that we can understand.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Dan Rome, author of Blah, 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 What to Do When Words Don't Work. Dan, when you talk to the White House about your ideas and how to communicate this healthcare bill, what response did you get from them?
There were a couple of responses, Jason, and the first one is, Dan, thank you. This is a fascinating way to explore complex issues of policy. We should do this more. So enthusiasm. Then comes reality. It's very, very difficult for the White House to work with outside consultants. I didn't know that. Who knew? Because of the process the White House needs to go through in order to make sure that any contractor working in the White House has been rigorously, you know, taken through the entire process to make sure that there's nothing untoward, makes it very difficult for them in any way to hire me. So what I've been able to do is on a couple of occasions work with the White House just on an advisory basis with the Office of Communications and in particular the new media part. So it's mostly the younger folks, that are really interested in getting the word out through all of the social media and through the websites, incredibly effective, really inspired by what you could use with pictures. So the advice to me from them was, because it is challenging to get in and work with the White House, that I would be better off if I went directly to two different departments, the Department of Defense and the Department of State, two large agencies that embrace new thinking and clarity of thinking because they so much have the big messages that are shifting all the time. You think about it, Department of Defense, Department of State, in a way setting policy, but at the same time having to react globally to whatever comes up around the world, needing to make sure that, let's say, we're going to do a surge in Afghanistan. Does the public support that? Why would we do that? So that's the direction I've started to move. So I've had an opportunity now to work with the Chief of Naval Operations and the Naval War College up in Newport and give a half-day workshop with some of the senior officers there on vivid thinking, visuals plus verbal, and it was incredible.
Through these experiences, what have you learned about our government and how it works?
Our government is complicated. There's no doubt about that. Our government is very big, and our government needs to be big. Think about what the government has to do. It is taking care of everything from national defense. I was just in a workshop this morning, and there were several people from the FDIC. So all the way from national defense to the first line of defense and protection of our banking system, all the way through Social Security. The government is responsible for making sure that we are taken care of to the best of the government's ability, augmenting what we do ourselves from the time we're born right up until the time we pass away. Incredible responsibility. It's not a surprise that it's complicated. Now, I am a Washington outsider. I do not live in Washington, D.C. I come here probably about once a quarter these last few years. I live out in San Francisco, and I'll tell you, it's very easy being an outsider to look at Washington and say, what the heck is going on over there? Make up your mind. Move ahead. What was with this crazy debt debacle a couple of months ago? What's the super committee going to do? Why does it seem that everything's at loggerheads? From the outside, it's easy to be critical. It's always refreshing to me when I do come here and meet people that are working here and realize how difficult it is. You've got a lot of people who face extraordinarily difficult challenges in extraordinarily short timelines with far less than perfect information. Is it any wonder that out of that is going to emerge what appears to the outside world to be a lot of blah, blah, blah? That being reality, the fact that it is complicated and a lot of paperwork's going to get churned out, it is absolutely critical to Washington, to the government, all aspects of the government to say, we understand how critical it is that people understand what we're doing. We are going to dedicate resources and time to thinking through our ideas in a vivid way, in a clear way, and then presenting it out so that people do understand it. You have to. In a democracy, it's what was, you know, John Adams, everyone else has said, you've got to have an informed, educated electorate or else the system doesn't work. We've got to make our messages clear.
Have you found that the use of video, viral video, videos on the web goes along with some of the things that you're trying to communicate?
It's a double-edged sword. All social media is a double-edged sword because on the one hand, I'm a Twitter fanatic. It's wonderful to be able to try to compress my message down into 140 characters and then send it out to a few thousand people in one keystroke. So that's great. The downside is it's not a medium that lends itself to deep thinking. And so what happens is we start to become maybe a little overly reactive. And it's interesting because if you watch social media, and whether it's Twitter or Facebook or Google Plus or any of the others, when everything is followed by trend. And what we need to be careful of is we need to make sure that we're sending messages out short and quick. That's wonderful that we can do that. But we need to make sure that they're still thoughtful messages. Have we really thought through, rather than reacting to everything and letting the trends overwhelm us? It's the same thing with the large media, too.
Yeah.
The media and social media serves an incredible role in getting the message out fast. My concern is to make sure that we're still thinking things through deeply enough that we're not just sending out a fast message, but we're sending out a thoughtful message as well.
And then making decisions based on the reaction to those messages.
Based on two things. If we are solely making our decisions based on reaction to Twitter, for an example, we're going to find ourselves in a lot of trouble. I mean, there's a reason why they called it Twitter. It's a bunch of birds out there tweeting, you know? Flip, 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 flip. And you wouldn't want to run a government that way. Government, this is the other thing I've learned. Government is complex, and thank goodness government sometimes is hard to move. because we need to have a mature adult who's along with us, who's thinking long-term as well. And more than anything else, when I think about what the government should be doing, it's the long-term thinking. And I will say that in the last couple of years, and I know this is not just for me, it's feeding into the blah, 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 there's a sense of a lack of a longer-term direction because we're so busy reacting to the things in front of us right now. We need a rapid deployment force in the government that can react to things. We need, again, the FDIC that can react to a bank crisis. But at the same time, we need people who are thinking long-term and are still able to communicate to us in vivid detail what is the strategic direction.
For people who feel overwhelmed by information, overwhelmed by getting through a lot of information to get to the thing that they really need to learn about or really need to find, are you able to help them with that through your technique?
Absolutely. So what I call vivid thinking, again, it's a mnemonic device. Jason, I have a terrible memory. So I rely on mnemonic devices and memory tricks all the time. So vivid, the reason I like that is if you think about the spelling of the word, V-I-V-I-D, what to me that stands for is visual, verbal, interdependent thinking. Visual and the verbal are interdependent. I can't just talk without drawing, nor can I just draw without talking. I have to put the two together. The answer to your question is, how do I sift through the mountain of things that I need to do and be aware of? Reality says I'm not going to be able to get through it all. So what I have to do is let my radar, my triage department right up front, look at everything that's coming in and make some quick decisions about what's most important right now. Put off some of the other stuff for the time being. And then I literally do map out the ideas that I'm interested in pursuing. I literally do take a pen and a piece of paper and say, here are the people that are involved. And I always start with, here are the players. Here's the people that are involved, and here's how they're interacting. And out of that, I come up with a picture, and then I feel like I understand the idea.
Dan, lastly, you had a good story in your book about Jon Stewart, yeah, host of The Daily Show.
Absolutely.
And he had a confession.
Yes, he did.
Tell us about that.
So Jon Stewart and Terry Gross. Now, Terry Gross from National Public Radio, who's generally considered one of the great interviewers of all time. She's read every book and talked to every author and musician and movie star. So you have Jon Stewart on stage with Terry Gross. They're in New York City, and they're just kind of bantering back and forth in front of an audience. And at one point, Terry Gross says to Jon Stewart, you know, how do you get through all of those books that you read? And Jon Stewart says, yeah, I read every one of them, the front and the back cover. And it turns out that in order to get through those books, he's a fast reader, so he reads as much as he can. And Jon Stewart was right up front, and he said, you know, I read so much. I know so much. The information stays in my mind long enough to get through one broadcast, and then I forget it. And the example he gave is he said, you know, in the morning I might read a book about, say, the construction of the Pentagon, and I'll know all about how the Pentagon site was located and how it was built. And then at the end of the day, I'm like, there's a building with five sides? Where'd that come from? Point I want to make is sometimes, even for the smart kids, the Jon Stewarts and the Terry Gross, even for the smart kids, they get overwhelmed by the amount of information coming in. Let's not limit the amount coming in. Let's just make sure that when it comes in, we have a way to make it stick. And that's what I call vivid thinking.
Dan Rome, author of Blah, 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 What to Do When Words Don't Work. Dan, thank you for your time.
Jason, my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue from the Excellence in Government Conference with Hooks Book Events President Perry Pigeon Hooks.
Is staying within budget at the top of your holiday list this year? Purchasing power can help. Get the season's hottest computers, tablets, and electronics in time for the holidays and pay for them over 12 months through easy payroll deduction with Purchasing Power. No upfront cash or credit checks required. Shop by December 15th, and AFGE members will receive 10% off their total order with promo code AFGEMEMBER. That's all one word. Visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Joined now by Perry Pigeon Hooks, the president and co-founder of Hooks Book Events. Perry, welcome back to the program.
Jason, I'm so glad to be here. I love this. It's my favorite thing.
So, of course, we have you again at one of our favorite conferences, the Excellence in Government Conference here in Washington, D.C. Tell us a little bit about, again, what you're doing here and what your role is.
We are so excited to be here today with a marvelous speaker, Dan Rome, who got his fame from his first books on the back of a napkin, and now he's got a fabulous new book called Blah, Blah, Blah. And as some people say, this town is full of a lot of blah, blah, blah. So Dan is spot on to be the keynote luncheon address today.
And, of course, we had Dan on the program earlier today, and he gave us some insight into his book, Blah, Blah, Blah. What is your take on that?
I think he's what I got out of it today, and we had a wonderful intimate breakfast with him, with some of our government clients, to kind of get a really face-to-face with him, that 65% of our brain works on visual cues, but we tend to use too many words in trying to get our point across. And his premise is, let's use words and pictures to make a point. And he does that. Very complicated ideas, he simplifies with both pictures and words. Amazing.
As someone who specializes in books, how does that make you feel to incorporate pictures a little bit into something that you do so frequently, which is read?
Well, think of it when you were a kid. He brought up Dr. Seuss. It was in the 50s when we all realized that the children weren't learning how to read. And Dr. Seuss had done, which I forgot his real name, decided that if we added pictures and drawings that go along with the words, the children could read better. The reading scores went up. Then we take all the pictures out of the books as soon as the kids get to like elementary school. And I think the reading skills have gone down. So if people are reading and getting new ideas, I'm all for it. And I think drawings and pictures, if that enhances it, let's go for it.
How do you think that will play going forward in this sort of over-information age that we live in?
I think he's absolutely, the timing is right. We looked today at our breakfast with him at the 1,500-page healthcare bill, and I think you two talked about that earlier today. It's 1,500 pages of words and bullet points. No one understands it. He took that 1,500 pages, he took 41 small napkins and drew out the entire thing on napkins, and the White House called him in, as you know, to come help explain a very complicated project.
So, of course, he was the keynote speaker here today for the luncheon at the Excellence in Government Conference. You brought him in here, and that's sort of what you do. You take these authors and you take them around to places around D.C., around the country, to educate people on things they may need a little help with.
Exactly. So we do private book and author events for our clients. A lot of U.S. government working to gain some more in the corporate world. We do events in Washington, New York, and a little bit in Boston. Our thinking is that if you've got a bunch of people and employees and you're trying to get them on the same page around your strategy, bring in somebody, a thought leader with an idea that relates to their business, and get them talking about how they could do their business better. That's what happens today with Dan Rome. Everyone left with a new idea and a better way to do their job.
Now, we are living in a complicated time. There's a lot happening around the country. There's intense debates about a number of serious topics. How is it that what you're doing with these book authors is sort of changing and moving the conversation forward?
Well, that's a great question, and that's what we try to do. That is actually the real gist and the energy behind this business, that the consciousness that creates the problem can't be the consciousness that fixes it. That's from Einstein. So you come in and you bring somebody that's smarter with a new idea, you get people brainstorming around it, and maybe they come up with a way that maybe fixes maybe a leadership problem in their organization, or maybe fixes an idea around sustainability. We work with EPA, we work with DOD, we work with Treasury, we work with all the agencies that have these huge problems. You get their employees together. They're smart people. They're driven by the mission. Get them in front of somebody who may have a new idea on how to approach that, and they will toss the ball forward, and they will move the agenda forward. And I think it shows up, too. I think earlier this week, the best places to work in government came out, and one of our clients, the FDIC, is at the top of that list. They care about their employees, and they bring in speakers and try to engage their employees in good conversations on a regular basis.
You bring up a good point. You say the FDIC, they scored very high. You also said they cared about their employees.
Yes.
Do you think those two things really go hand in hand?
Yes, absolutely. I've been working with the government for more than 10 years, and I cannot tell you how many times they come up after this event and say, I cannot believe my agency did that for me. That was so great. I'm so happy to meet this writer. I'm so happy to have this book. That's a wonderful opportunity for me to meet other coworkers, get a book, get a new idea. Absolutely. It shows they care.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Perry Hooks, president and co-founder of Hooks Book Events. Perry, in addition to obviously what you've done here today at the Excellence in Government Conference, you have a long list of authors that you're placing in different agencies, different businesses. Tell us about some of those.
We are really excited. We're actually working almost up till Christmas. We just recently took Tom Brokaw to a big event at the Board of Trade. December 2nd, we have Jim Clifton on jobs, which if anybody here is listening to this, they're welcome to join us at the Board of Trade. We also have Dr. Henry Kissinger at the Board of Trade event in December. Excited to be working with Neil Ferguson out of Harvard, taking him into some of the financial services agencies. We've got some great leadership titles coming up, Joseph Grinney on Crucial Conversations, some science books we're taking to some of our science clients. It's really an amazing list, and if you go to our website at hooksbookevents.com, you can download that list and see if anybody you'd like to bring to your agency.
Now, I see here Andrew McAfee, a former guest of ours, actually here at the Excellence in Government Conference some time ago. What's he up to?
Well, he's doing a very interesting joint book with another brainiac from MIT, and they're only issuing this book in digital form. So I'm very excited. Actually, you know, again, I like to sell books and support our local independent book retailers. But I think we're going to try it with Andy, who's so smart, and he's talking about this age of information, and it's a wonderful new concept and how it's going to change the way we work, that I really want to work with him, even though it's only a digital version of the book. But, you know, that's the way it's going, and I need to adapt my business to that.
And that's a great question. What's the digital transformation doing for you? How's that impacting what you're doing?
Well, I call it the digital tsunami, and actually I think it's not a bad idea. You know, a Kindle, an iPad, if people are reading and getting ideas, it's expanding people's in getting information. So that is not a bad thing. But what I do think, and I'm talking to the writers about this, books are still important. Actually holding the physical third dimensional book, that's important. I love that. I love my signed first edition library. That's marvelous. But again, I want the ideas out there almost as much as I want the books out there. And the other thing I think Hooks Book Events offers is a chance to sit down and meet Dan Pink, Dan Rome, Neil Ferguson, Andy McAfee. You know, the event portion of this, I think, is going to stay critical because you want to get that smart man or woman in the room to talk about their idea, whether the idea is in a third dimensional book or it's actually on your Kindle or iPad and digital. So we're just going to try to work around that and incorporate that. It's like a finger on a dike. It's coming. Don't run with it. Incorporate it. Manage it is how what I'm doing.
How have your audiences responded to the face-to-face interaction with some of these authors?
They love it. It's incredible. It's really, that's really, to me, the most fun part of this. When I see the individual coming up at the end of the event with their book to get it signed and having that personal interaction with their, possibly their hero. I mean, there are many people I'm bringing their heroes to their offices, and they bring the backlist to get signed. They just want to shake their hand, whether it's, like I said, a Dan Pink or a Dan Rome or a Dan Ariely. We love the Dans. You know, they want to see them. They admire their work, and it's kind of like a rock star.
And on that notion of face-to-face communication, as technology improves and the digital age advances and we have all of these luxuries to help us be more productive, do you think in a way that sometimes it removes that face-to-face interaction, that personal communication?
Oh, I do. And I think you see that with children on Facebook and Twitter. They don't know how to interact with each other in person. I think that's what we're trying to solve, that with these personal events.
What are the consequences of that?
I think if you can't interact with people that understand facial and visual clues, I think it makes you less effective as a human walking around, just buying groceries or interacting with taxi drivers or whatever you're interacting. So I think meeting with your coworkers, networking with your coworkers around a book idea and around with a really smart guy in the room, you're working on your brain and also your social cues and learning how to interact with people. I think it's a problem, and I make my kids turn it off, and they're not allowed to use them at dinner. No iPhones at the dinner table. We're talking and we're looking at each other. We are not on the machine when we're having a meal.
And do you find that to be part of the development process for young people?
Yes.
To learn how to deal with others?
Yes. And I think you're seeing that it's less and less, they're less good at it the more they're on these devices. Interesting article in the New York Times recently that many of these guys out in Silicon Valley are sending their kids to the Waldorf schools out on the West Coast because there are no digital devices allowed in the schools. So these are the guys creating them, are not letting their kids play with them. Learn to cut up the apple to learn about math. So I kind of like that.
So I was taking another look here at your list, and I saw a previous guest that you had on, David Walker, who was also one of our guests here on Inside Government. What's he up to now that his days as the Comptroller General?
Oh, he's amazing. He's got the Comeback America Initiative. And we've actually been doing webinars with him as very successfully. We just recently did for a client. We've done a lot with him. He's talking about the debt crisis. And when we heard a rumor, he was running for Senate in Connecticut, but then we heard that was more of a rumor than fact. But super smart guy, really deeply concerned about what's going on as far as the budget and our deficit. Check out his website at Comeback America. And see what he's doing. Because, and if you're interested in a webinar with him, we could certainly help you with that.
And into 2012, what do you have planned?
Well, we're booking it. Our darling friend Bob Schiller has a new book coming out in April, and we've taken him to all of our financial services clients as well as our financial agency clients. That's coming out. Books go in seasons like clothing, so there'll be a big rush in the March-April window, and we're looking forward to a really robust spring. Some books we're working on, and I can't say what they are because I don't have 100% confirmation, but there's some great books around entrepreneurship, financial services, a lot of good history books, leadership. Too many books, too little time.
Perry Pidgeon Hooks, president of Hooks Book Events. Perry, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jason. See you next time.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss efforts to extend the payroll tax cuts with Campaign for America's Future co-director Roger Hickey.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Joined now by Roger Hickey, the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Roger, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Jason, and your audience.
So the campaign is asking GOP congressional leaders to renew the payroll tax cut and long-term unemployment insurance. Tell us about this.
Well, we're really challenging the Republicans and their leaders to show us anything at all that they are doing or trying to do to create jobs in America when we have 9.5% official unemployment and 15 or 20 or more, depending on the population, of unemployment levels in reality. It's a crisis. The Republicans have forced the whole national legislative debate onto this super committee and reducing and going after important programs like Social Security. They failed at that because we've defeated them. We're now trying to put the spotlight on the fact that the Republican leaders have no plans that could create jobs whatsoever, and we're urging them to tell us what they would do about extending unemployment insurance, for example, which is one of the best things you could do to get money in people's pockets at a time like this.
In terms of the payroll tax cut, is there a resistance there by GOP congressional leaders to extend that?
There's a resistance in general by GOP leaders and rank and file to do anything that helps the 99% of Americans who are suffering and dealing with this economy. There's a reluctance to do anything that, quote, costs money, even though the last time many of them voted for this payroll tax cut, and they voted for extending the unemployment insurance without, quote, paying for it. The point we're trying to make is that at a time of high levels of unemployment, putting money in people's pockets is the best thing to do in order to get private businesses investing and growing and hiring people. And we're challenging the Republicans to say why they're resisting that.
Has the payroll tax cut helped job creation in this last year?
Well, as you and all of our listeners know, the economy is stuck in this miserable level of basically stagnation. It's growing only very slightly, not enough to really replace the jobs that were lost during the Great Recession, or to keep up with the new entrants to the labor force. It's a very, very bad economy. There is, to be honest, there should be much, much bolder things done. And I hope that the political campaigns will talk about public investment in schools and bridges and roads and getting public employees in the states and in the federal level back working again who have been laid off. That's what we ought to be talking about. That's what the Republicans absolutely refuse to talk about. So we're zeroing in on the few things that Republicans in the past have agreed with Democrats that might help a little bit, might help us prevent sinking into a recession. And believe me, they are on the defensive. They don't have anything to say to the voters that they're in favor of that would create jobs.
And so then what do you think is the what's behind the resistance to this?
It's ideological. The Republican Party is dedicated to the well-being of the top 1% of the population that has been doing very, very well. They think their ideology leaves them to think that the best way to create jobs is to give more tax breaks to the very wealthy. And we saw that in the negotiations over the so-called super committee, where they were charged with bringing down the deficit. They refused to talk about rolling back the tax cuts for the very wealthy that George Bush instituted before he left office. They are bound by their ideology to only help the wealthy. They call them the job creators. And that eventually that they claim the jobs will trickle down to the rest of us. The fact is that when there's not a large number of workers with money in their pockets able to buy goods and services in the economy, the so-called job creators don't create any jobs at all. They sit on their money. They invest it overseas. We need more demand in the economy, and the Republican Party doesn't understand that.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Roger, programs or initiatives like the payroll tax cut or long-term unemployment aid, how does that impact a typical American middle-class family?
Well, most Americans are struggling from paycheck to paycheck if they're lucky enough to have a job at all. They're coming up on the holidays, and they're not sure whether they're going to have to be able to even buy presents for their kids, much less take a vacation. So the idea behind the payroll tax holiday is less is taken out of everybody's paycheck. Everybody who normally pays the FICA tax, and that goes right into their spending, especially for low-income people. The extension of unemployment insurance means that these people that have been hanging on for a long time, hoping to find a job, at least would have an extension of unemployment insurance, so they'd be able to get through the next few months. The theory is, it's not a theory, it's reality. If people who are at the limits of their spending ability get a few more $100 or $1,000, they are likely to go out and spend it right away, benefiting local merchants, benefiting the manufacturers who made the things that they bought, and a virtuous cycle gets going that causes jobs to be created. At the very least, we should be doing these minimal things to make sure that the economy doesn't fall back into recession, and that working people or people unemployed have the ability to keep their families together in these hard times.
Do you see not renewing the payroll tax cuts or eliminating the long-term unemployment aid as things that could put the country back into a recession?
It absolutely could. We are in the most fragile of economic circumstances right now. The banks are not lending to small business. Small business is not investing. And then you have the added worry about what's happening in Europe and the possibility that the European crisis could shock the banks worldwide and limit the amount of goods and services we can export to Europe. So we are in a very, very fragile state. This economy needs all the help we can get it. That's why what the Republicans ought to be getting behind is what Obama put on the table. The president said the American Jobs Act would invest in rebuilding schools and roads and bridges. He said that we would get public employees back to work. And we should be doing a whole lot more to goose this economy in the right direction of growth and job creation. At the very least, we should not be tampering with the few things that Republicans used to agree with the Democrats on to keep the economy out of a recession.
Roger, do you think that it's possible to get the country moving forward without banks lending, without small businesses investing?
You know, alas, because the Republicans are refusing to act on anything big, I think we're going to have to go through this next year of political debate while the economy stays at this low level of anemic growth until the American people make a choice. And they've really got to make a choice about whether we want to go forward with job creation and growth or whether we're going to stick with a political system that's devoted to enriching the 1% at the expense of all of us.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue with Campaign for America's Future co-director Roger Hickey on job creation in America.
Is staying within budget at the top of your holiday list this year? Purchasing power can help. Get the season's hottest computers, tablets, and electronics in time for the holidays and pay for them over 12 months through easy payroll deduction with Purchasing Power. No upfront cash or credit checks required. Shop by December 15th, and AFGE members will receive 10% off their total order with promo code AFGEMEMBER. That's all one word. Visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Roger Hickey, the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Roger, before the break, we were talking about job creation and what it's going to take to get people back to work. Recently in Ohio, the electorate came out pretty strongly in favor of preserving collective bargaining rights for public workers. How does that win tie into job creation in this country?
Well, it definitely shows that working people of all kinds, unionized and non-unionized, don't want to see the governors of our states restricting the rights of labor, the rights of working people to negotiate for better jobs and better wages. And it demonstrates that the American voters in the heartland understand that the middle class is in trouble, and they don't want the politicians worsening the future of middle class working people. So where the states are on a terrible death spiral, where they are cutting people's wages, they are cutting people's pensions. Many of these governors are being rejected when they try to do that. But if they were to get what they want, that simply means fewer people able to buy the products that the manufacturers and the service sector in the state of Ohio produce, and therefore they have less tax income to do the things that government needs to do. We've got to reverse that spiral, and the great sign is that the people of Ohio, which is sometimes a fairly conservative state, came together and fought back, and they said, no, we're not going to let this kind of Republican austerity destroy our economy and destroy our middle class. It's a very, very good sign that in the election coming up next year, the American people all over the country are going to say, we stand with politicians who are going to fight for jobs, not politicians who are going to destroy the middle class.
What kind of message does this victory for workers and their right to collectively bargain send to other states who may be trying to limit those rights as well?
Well, it's happening. The same battle started in Wisconsin, and you've seen the people of Wisconsin really inspired the whole country with their willingness to fight back against the governor. It really means that this group of super conservative governors who got elected in 2010, they campaigned on creating jobs. But what they did was they imposed austerity and hurt the middle class. And the public is demanding that politicians fight for jobs in the middle class, or else they're going to lose those governor's jobs and those legislative jobs. And it's a good indication for the national election as well.
Despite that win in Ohio, the work is not done there. Where is the state going next?
Well, I think every one of these states needs a Congress in Washington and a president in Washington who's willing to fight for jobs. The states on their own have a constitutional requirement that they balance their budget. That means that they engage in layoffs, which hurt the economy. What we need is a government in Washington that can stimulate the economy, put people to work, target jobs into states like Ohio, and help the state governments pay for their public employees so that they don't have to lay off firefighters and teachers and cops. And we can reverse that spiral. So victories in those states are very, very important, and it's very important that political champions like Sherrod Brown in Ohio and members of Congress, candidates for Congress all over the country, who say that they're really going to go to Washington and fight for jobs, get the support of this citizens' rebellion that's going on.
On an individual or job-by-job basis, people generally come out in support for teachers, firefighters, police officers. Given that, why do you think that overall there seems to be a sentiment against public workers, despite knowing the value that they provide the community?
Well, I don't think there is. I think that what we saw in a place like Wisconsin is the governor trying to pit people who are in the private sector against people in the public services. He tried that and he failed. He wanted to say, look, you guys are having trouble in the private sector getting pensions. Therefore, these people who teach our children or fight the fires shouldn't have pensions either, or they should be cut back. That's a powerful argument. It did not work because the voters in Wisconsin and Ohio really saw that if you undermine one group of workers, everybody's going to get undermined. Pretty soon there won't be any pensions at all. Same is true of wages. The attempt to split different kinds of workers was tried, and it failed. It's called solidarity when workers join together. And I thought it was very inspiring that the firefighters in Wisconsin, who weren't going to be subject to the terrible legislation that the governor tried to do, they weren't going to be restricted in their collective bargaining. They stood with the other workers who were under attack. The solidarity worked, and I think it's what we're seeing is that people understand that attack on one is an attack on everybody. The middle class needs help, and we need to stick together.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Roger, there has been an ongoing debate about what's more important, creating jobs now or reducing the deficit now. Where do you stand on that?
There's really no contest in that debate. If we don't get the economy growing, if we stay stuck in this low-grade recession, we'll never balance the budget because we won't have enough people working to pay into our tax system to pay for government, essential government that we need. So one of the best things that we can do to lower our long-term budget problem is to spend money now, even grow the deficit for a bit in order to get this recovery going, in order to get the private sector confident enough to invest in long-term investment. And if we do that, then and only then can we get the deficit down. We have a long-term problem with health care in our economy because we have such an inefficient health care system. We need to reorganize health care, not cut Medicare and Social Security. And if we did that, we'd handle the problem long-term. But growth by itself and the creation of healthy job creation would really do wonders for our deficit. And it's amazing that the government in Washington is only now starting to see that. It's why the president has shifted to a focus on jobs and economic growth.
And do you see infrastructure investment and investment in public services as a long-term strategy to have the economy thrive?
It's both a long-term strategy and a short-term strategy. One of the amazing things in all of this is that because the United States is such a big economy, we have people from all over the world putting money in the United States, and interest rates are incredibly low right now. People have fled to the United States for security, and that means that if government borrows money to build a bridge or to redo an airport, we're getting money at almost free rates. We're not going to have those low interest rates forever. So now is the perfect time to use government investment to spur the recovery of the economy, putting people together to work on fast projects. At the same time, we ought to be launching long-term efforts that can be the drivers of prosperity for the future, renewable energy, transportation systems that make our economy more efficient. And over the long term, that can drive future growth the way our investment in the space program, the way our investment in technology did in prior decades. So it's both a short-term way to get the economy growing and a long-term way to prosperity.
Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Always a pleasure, Roger.
Good to be with you. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you to our guest this week, author Dan Rome, Hooks Book Events President Perry Pigeon Hooks, and Campaign for America's Future co-director Roger Hickey. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by...